Reading today from the Srimad Bhagavatam, beginning the 12th canto, chapter 6. We'll be reading the chapter summary and then doing texts 1 through 7. So I'll begin by reading the summary. This chapter describes Maharaj Bricket's attainment of liberation, Maharaj Janmanjaya's performance of sacrifice for killing all snakes, the origin of the Vedas, and Srila Vedavyasa's dividing of the Vedic literature. After hearing the words of Sri Shukadev, Maharaj Bricket stated that he had listened to the Bhagavatam, which is the compendium of the Puranas, and which is full of the nectarian pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Uttama Shloka. Bricket had attained the transcendental position of fearlessness and oneness with the Supreme. His ignorance had been dispelled, and by the mercy of Sri Shukadev, he had gained insight, had gained sight of the supremely auspicious personal form of God, namely the personality of Godhead Sri Hari. As a result, he had cast aside all fear of death. Sri Bricket Maharaj then begged Shukadev Goswami to permit him to fix his heart upon the lotus feet of Lord Hari and give up his life. Granting this permission, Sri Shukadev rose and departed. Subsequently, Maharaj Bricket, freed from all doubts, sat down in the yogic posture and merged himself in meditation upon the Supersoul. Then the snake bird Takshaka arrived in the disguise of a Brahmin, bit him, and the body of the saintly king immediately burned to ashes. Janmanjaya, the son of Bricket, became very angry when he received news of his father's death, and he began a sacrificial performance for the purpose of destroying all the snakes. Even though Takshaka received protection from Indra, he nevertheless became attracted by the mantras and was about to fall into the fire. Seeing this, Brihaspati, the son of Angira Rishi, came and advised Maharaj Janmanjaya that Takshaka could not be killed because he had drunk the nectar of the demigods. Furthermore, Angira said that all living entities must enjoy the fruits of their past activities. Therefore, the king should give up the sacrifice. Janmanjaya was thus convinced by the words of Brihaspati and stopped his sacrifice. Thereafter, Suda Goswami, in response to questions from Sri Shonaka, described the divisions of the Vedas. From the heart of the topmost demigod Brahma came the subtle transcendental vibration, and from the subtle sound vibration arose the syllable Om, greatly potent and self-luminous. Using this Omkara, Lord Brahma created the original Vedas and taught them to his sons, Marichi and others, who were all saintly leaders of the Brahmin community. This body of Vedic literature was handed down through the specific succession of spiritual masters until the end of Dwapar Yuga, when Lord Vyasadeva divided into four parts and instructed various schools of sages in these four samhitas. When the sage Yajnavalkya was rejected by his spiritual master, he had to give up all the Vedic mantras he had received from him. To obtain new mantras of the Yajurveda, Yajnavalkya worshipped the Supreme Lord in the form of the sun god. Sri Suryadeva subsequently fulfilled his prayer. So we have a lot coming up in this chapter. So we'll chant text one together. Sutu vacha. Etan nishamya muninabhitam parikshid. Nabhitam parikshid. Do we have it? We don't have it. Okay. Etam nishamya muninabhitam parikshid.
Etam nishamya muninabhitam parikshid.
Vyasatma jena nikilatma drishe samena.
Vyasatma jena nikilatma drishe samena.
Tat padamulam upashritya nitena murdhna. But Hanjalas Tamidam Ahasa Vishnurata. Etan Nishamya Muninabhitam Parikshid.
Etan
Yasatma Jaina Nikilatma Drisha Samena.
Yasatma Jaina Nikilatma Drisha Samena.
Tat Pada Mulam Upashritya Natena Murtha. Padhanjalas Tamidam Ahasa Vishnurata.
Padhanjalas Tamidam Vishnurata.
Now this chant. Word for word, Sutta Vacha. Sutta Goswami said, Etat, this, Nishamya, hearing, Munina, by the sage Shukadev, Abhihitam, narrated, Parikshit, Maharaj Parikshit, Yasatma Jaina, by the son of Vyasadeva, Nikila, of all living beings, Atma, the Supreme Lord, Drisha, who sees, Samena, who is perfectly equipoised, Tat, of him Shukadev, Padamulam, to the lotus feet, Uparshicha, going up, Natena, bow down, Murdna, with his head, Bada Anjali, his arms folded in supplication, Tum, to him, Idam, this, Aha, said, Sa, he, Vishnurata, Prakrit, who was still in the womb, who, while still in the womb, had been protected by Lord Krishna himself. Still in the womb, had been protected by Lord Krishna himself. Okay, translation and purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. Sutta Goswami said, after hearing all that was narrated by him, by the self-realized and equipoised Shukadev, the son of Vyasadeva, Maharaj Parikshit humbly approached his lotus feet. Bowing his head down upon the sage's feet, the king, who had lived his entire life under the protection of Lord Vishnu, folded his hands in supplication and spoke as follows. Report. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, some of the sages present while Shukadev was instructing King Pariksit were impersonalist philosophers. Thus the word Samena indicates that in the previous chapter, Shukadev Goswami had spoken the philosophy of self-realization in a way pleasing to such intellectual yogis. So we'll speak more about that, but for the sake of continuity, I'll just read through the remaining verses here. And I'll just read English again, for the sake of time here. Maharaj Pariksit said, I have now achieved the purpose of my life because a great and merciful soul like you has shown such kindness to me. You have personally spoken to me this narration of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, who is out with beginning or end. Next three. I do not consider it all amazing that a great soul such as yourself, whose minds are always absorbed in the infallible personality of Godhead, show mercy to the foolish conditioned souls, tormented as we are by the problems of life. Four. I have heard from you the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the perfect summary of all the Puranas, which perfectly describes the Supreme Lord Uttama Shloka. Five. My Lord, I now have no fear of Takshaka or any other living being, or even of repeated deaths, because I have absorbed myself in that purely spiritual absolute truth which you have revealed and which destroys all fears. Six. O Brahman, please give me the permission to resign my speech and the functions of all my senses unto Lord Adhokshaja. Allow me to absorb my mind, purified of lusty desires, within him and to thus give up my life. Purport. Shukadev Goswami asked King Pariksit, what more do you wish to hear? Now the king replies that he has perfectly understood the message of Srimad Bhagavatam and that he is ready, without further discussion, to go back home, back to Godhead. And text 7 is the last verse in this in Pariksit's reply. It says, you have revealed to me that which is most auspicious, the supreme personal feature of the Lord. I am now fixed in knowledge and self-realization, and my ignorance has been eradicated. Om Jnana Tam Randasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksulami Tamina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Panchako Patrivischa Kripa Sindhu Devacha Patitano Pavane Bio Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. So we're coming to the, I was going to say, the end of Maharaj Pariksit, the end of this pastime. Obviously, Maharaj Pariksit with his leaving his body in this chapter. And, of course, we're also getting some very important instructions from the Srimad Bhagavatam on the nature of the Absolute Truth and the nature of the relationship of the devotee and Krishna. This few verses by Pariksit is an answer to the last statement, the last question at the end of Chapter 5. At the end of Chapter 5, Shukadev says, my dear beloved King Pariksit, I have narrated to you the topics you originally inquired about the pastimes of Lord Hari, the supreme soul of the universe. Now, what more do you wish to hear? So, this is what he is answering. Maharaj Pariksit basically saying that he fully understands. He really does not need to hear more. He gets it. He understands fully all the philosophy that's been enunciated by Shukadev Goswami, and he's ready to leave his body without fear. So that's a very, very important point. Now, there's a reference in the purport here to Shukadev Goswami's instructions about impersonal realization. This comes from the next to the last verse in Chapter 5, previously, where Shukadev says, you should consider I am non-different from the Absolute Truth, the Supreme Abode, and that Absolute Truth, the Supreme Destination, is non-different from me. So, as a sort of final statement, you would think he would say something about the lotus feet of Krishna or something much more personal about the relationship of Maharaj Pariksit and Krishna, but he ends in this note, which is mentioned here, is somewhat of a understanding of Brahman or an impersonal understanding. Now, In the purport, it's mentioned that Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur states that he said this because there were impersonal philosophers in the audience. And sort of to satisfy them so that they could also gain something out of this, he gives this sort of nod to them. Because it's mentioned here that this is coming from Vishwanath, I did go back and read Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentaries, and he has a very, very extensive commentary in both the first verse of chapter 5 and then some later verses. And Vishwanath basically gives four reasons why Shukadeva might have right at the end given this sort of impersonal statement or impersonal understanding. First of all, as stated here, to satisfy the impersonals that were there, but also to give something to everyone. Just as in Bhagavad Gita, we have karma yoga, jnana yoga, shankha yoga. In other words, whatever one is inclined towards, Krishna is showing how that is a step on the way to the absolute truth. Perhaps not as high as bhakti, or as advanced and developed as the concept of bhakti yoga, but nevertheless, a legitimate path towards spiritual realization. So for those who are so inclined, and there were those in the audience, jnanis and brahmins and some of the yogis, he's saying, yes, you can at least understand the absolute truth, Brahman. He also mentions that bhakti is kept somewhat hidden for those who are not prepared to understand or are not ready or not advanced enough. So it's not always revealed all the glories of bhakti to those who are not ready to hear it. In fact, this is a statement we have that one shouldn't actually present the more esoteric aspects of bhakti yoga to those who are faithless or those who can't. In fact, that's even an offense against the chanting of the holy name to preach to the faithless. So that is there a little bit also, as mentioned. Another reason it's mentioned is that it was a test of Maharaj Prickett's resolve. In other words, throw out a little bit, well, what about impersonalism or what about merging into Brahman? And of course, Maharaj Prickett completely rejects it. And he said he's only clinging to the lotus feet of Krishna. So it gives Prickett an opportunity to, in the pages of the Bhagavatam, reassert his complete faith in the process of bhakti and his, attachment to Krishna and Krishna's lotus feet. And then Vishwanath also says that in this particular verse 11, whatever it is, that there's an esoteric meaning. And this often happens that because the Srimad Bhagavatam, of course, is so absolutely brilliantly written, sometimes our acharyas and the Goswamis will tell us that the words are written in such a way that there can be alternate meanings. In other words, for one who is an advanced devotee, they might understand the verse in a different way. So he says that the esoteric meaning of that particular verse is, you will not see your body bitten by the snake or the universe different from yourself. The other meaning is, you will not see all of this because you will be fainting with bliss from directly seeing the lotus feet of Krishna. So apparently the advanced devotees can understand from the words of the Srimad Bhagavatam that they are always pointing to Krishna, always pointing to the personal relationship of love between the devotees and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So as we go here towards the end of these six or seven verses that Prickett speaks, he says basically at the end here, he says, because I've absorbed myself in that purely spiritual absolute truth, which you revealed to me has destroyed all fear. He says, O Brahman, give me the permission to resign my speech and functions of all my senses unto Lord Bhokshaja. Allow me to absorb my mind, purified by lusty desires within him, and thus give up my life. You have revealed to me that which is most auspicious, the supreme personal feature of the Lord. Again, reasserting his understanding of the personal relationship with Krishna. Then he finally says, I am now fixed in knowledge and self-realization, and my ignorance has been eradicated. Does that remind anybody of anything? At the very end, saying my ignorance has been eradicated? Arjuna, yeah. That's what I thought of. This is like, at the very end of the Bhagavad Gita, in chapter 18, verses 72-73, practically within the last few verses of the Bhagavad Gita, this is also Arjuna's statement. Krishna says to Arjuna, O son of Partho, conqueror of wealth, have you heard this with attentive mind, and are your ignorance and illusions now dispelled? And Arjuna says, my dear Krishna, O infallible one, my illusion is now gone. I have regained my memory by your mercy. I am now free from doubt and prepared to act according to your instruction. So, again, important instructions that are also there in the Bhagavad Gita. Now here we're hearing at the end of the Srimad Bhagavatam how the devotee becoming enlightened by Krishna, by hearing the words of Krishna and spoken through his spiritual master, through his guru, becomes enlightened. His ignorance is destroyed, his doubts are destroyed, and thus becomes fearless. Maharaj Parikshit became fearless and able to now face giving up his body, whatever may come, the snake bird, whatever. Arjuna, now fully convinced, ready to go and fight this terrible battle against, millions of soldiers. So this great courage and fearlessness comes about from the resolve of the devotee when their ignorance and doubts are destroyed. It's really this freedom from illusion that removes fear and doubt. Because only when we are in the illusory concept that we are this body, we are this mind, we fear for her body. We all do. We naturally fear for the bodies that our soul is inhabiting. And therefore, we do have different doubts. So we do have fears of protection of the body. But now, Maharaj Parikshit is in a position where he has no fear of impending death, and he has absolutely no doubt about his relationship with Krishna. So it's interesting how this doubt and fear are often spoken about together. We have this idea of ignorance or illusion, we have doubts, and therefore, arising from those doubts based upon illusion and ignorance is fearfulness. It's interesting, and there's a term, akutabhayam, which basically means fearless or freedom from fear. I'm not sure quite the Sanskrit, but Prabhupada translates it twice. I notice as doubtless and fearless. So it's not, doubtless isn't always exactly in the translation of akutabhayam, but that's how Prabhupada translates it, which we can understand reveals, the deep meaning of it. And of course, the famous verse is, in Srimad Bhagavatam, second canto, first chapter, says, O King, constant chanting of the holy name of the Lord after the ways of the great authorities is the doubtless and fearless way of success for all, including those who are free from all material desires, those desires of material enjoyment, and are those who are self-satisfied by dint of transcendental knowledge. And then Prabhupada references it again, in a purport, in Srimad Bhagavatam 3:25-43, he says, the surrendered souls are called akutabhayam, free from all fear. They are doubtless and fearless, and their entrance into the spiritual kingdom is guaranteed. So this is the situation of Maharaj Parikshit, akutabhayam, doubtless and fearless, and therefore his entrance to the spiritual kingdom guaranteed. So the devotee is fearless. Why? Because Krishna says, I will protect you. He says, Sarva Dharma Prachaja, Mahasucha, do not fear. And in the purport, 1866, Srila Prabhupada explains this. He says, one should be confident that in all circumstances, Krishna will protect him from all difficulties. There's no need of thinking how should one keep the body and soul together. Krishna will see to that. One should always think himself helpless and should consider Krishna as the only basis for his progress in life. As soon as one seriously engages himself in devotional service to the Lord in full Krishna consciousness, at once he becomes free from all contamination of material nature. So, Prabhupada says one should be confident in Krishna's protection. Easier said than done, as I often say. Yes, one should be confident in Krishna's protection. And that's what we're seeing in the example of the great devotees, the surrendered souls like Arjuna and like Maharaj Parikshit. But of course, we're not always so confident. Sometimes we lose that confidence or it becomes a little shaky. And sometimes we might have some doubts and might even have some fear. So I was thinking about this idea of doubts. And it seems like there's two types of doubts. This is just something I was thinking, my understanding. One is based on ignorance, of not knowing. And the other is we might sometimes doubt is used a little more strongly, as in like a disbelief or not accepting. Like if we said, well, I really doubt the philosophy. I doubt Krishna consciousness. That means I don't believe it or I don't accept it. So we may hear that, especially from people who aren't devotees, but sometimes even devotees might have that disbelief. We probably don't say it so much because it's not a popular thing to say in the assembly of devotees, but sometimes devotees might feel that. But then often I think with devotees, it's more of we just aren't sure, we don't know, or we haven't realized fully. So I've always tried to be very careful about the second definition of doubt, to never reject Krishna or reject the spiritual master, the words of Srila Prabhupada. In other words, I think that can be sort of a fairly dangerous if we get into a situation of doubting the guru or doubting the Srimad Bhagavatam, doubting the words of Krishna. It's much safer position to say, I may not fully realize something. I may not fully understand this yet. And that's what I've always tried to do throughout my Krishna conscious career, is things I didn't understand or maybe even didn't even fully accept. I try to take the attitude, I do not fully understand this. I haven't had this realization yet. If I continue to serve Srila Prabhupada, continue to hear this philosophy, hopefully someday I will understand it better. And actually, over time, that often happens, right? We find things that in the beginning may have been difficult to understand, or we might have had some doubt about. We find, yes, it is true. Yes, it does work for me. Yes, I see more and more. And as we make a little advancement in Krishna consciousness, our realization is deeper. And we get more and more understanding, realization. And therefore, based upon that experience, the experience that I may have doubted something, but now I understand it, as I continue this practice of Krishna consciousness, continue to simply submissively hear the words of my spiritual master, therefore I can apply that to other things I may not have fully understood. All right? And sometimes things are just things that we just may not understand, like cosmology. You know, I probably will never understand everything to do with cosmology and where all the planets are located. I could try real hard and I could study it and maybe I could get it, but probably it would be difficult for me. But to me, that's not a question of doubt. You know, I'm sure it's all true, I just don't understand it. You know, I'm not smart enough, I don't get it. You know, so there are those types of things that we just understand. This may be something that I'm not really capable of fully understanding. And sometimes when we think about, if you go back into the last chapters of the Nectar of Devotion, the Bhaktisamrita Sindhu, do we all understand those very, very intricate, you know, very personal pastimes, you know, the rasas, all the different intricacies of rasa between Krishna and the gopi? Well, we don't understand those things. At least I don't. You know, I can't fully understand it. I can get it. You know, we start to get it. We get a feel for it. We get a basic understanding. We accept it. And we have perhaps a little bit lower level realizations in our own life. You know, so at least we get the principle. We can begin to get the principle of rasa, of relationship with Krishna, that Krishna reciprocates. We serve Krishna, and Krishna, we have a loving relationship with Krishna. We begin to feel that. But do we understand the depth of, you know, all the secondary rasas? And probably not. But that isn't the kind of doubt that disturbs our faith, right? That's more just, I don't understand that yet. I'm not that realized. I'm not that advanced. So I think if we take that attitude, I may not understand things yet, I'm not so advanced, I'm not so intelligent, you know, but look at everything that I have understood. Look at the things that we have learned, that Srila Prabhupada has given us from these incredible books. You know, the amount, the depth of philosophy that's given in Krishna consciousness, you do not find anywhere. And that's not just that we're rah-rah, you know, that we're being like partisan or sectarian. I mean, you actually see that. You can discover that. You can see it very objectively. You do not get this depth of philosophy in any other religious works and in the other scriptures, right? It just isn't there. I mean, this is the things that we're learning are just amazing. You know, and it's like the more that we study and the more that we read is just the more amazing it becomes, and the more, and it's not just amazing like, well, that's really far out, I don't get that. No, but it's actually very practical. It's things that we realize, that we understand, that become a part of our life, become true in our life. And as those experiences increase and continue, that strengthens our faith. And whatever doubts or misunderstandings may still be there, they don't become so important, really. Does it really matter whether I understand the distance, the relative distance of the sun and the moon from the earth? Is that going to help me go back to Godhead if I can really get that? Probably not. I have enough trouble understanding I'm not this body, the real basic chapter 2 Bhagavad Gita. If I could get that, I think I'd be in real good shape. If we could fully realize just that we're spirit, soul, eternal, part and parcel of Krishna, eternal servant of Krishna. If we could deeply realize the simple aspects of the philosophy, we would be doubtless and fearless, and our illusions would be eradicated. So it's not that we don't inquire, and it's not that we don't question. In fact, in the Bhagavad Gita 434, Tadvidi Pranipatena, our famous verse about the spiritual master, Prabhupada says in the purport, he says in this verse, both blind following and absurd inquiries are condemned. Not only should one hear submissively from the spiritual master, get a clear understanding from him in submission and service, and inquiries. So inquiries are there, not blind following, but not absurd inquiries, and there must be a mood of service. That's the clear understanding of that verse. If there's service and submission to the spiritual master and inquiry, then understanding comes. That, in fact, that understanding is imparted. Realization will be imparted to the disciple. So the beginning of our spiritual life, as always, is based on faith. Adau Shraddha. No, in the beginning there must be faith. That's really the beginning. And Prabhupada says, faith means unflinching trust in something sublime. That's Prabhupada's famous definition of faith. Unflinching trust in something sublime. Sublime means not so readily apparent, right? It means subtle. If it weren't subtle, then faith would be easy, right? In other words, while Krishna is standing in front of us, there on the altar, as Shyamasundar, but if Krishna in his original form as in Vrindavan, if we were seeing Krishna like the residents of Vrindavan, walking around, talking, doing something else, that wouldn't be so subtle. That would be real obvious and be real easy to have that kind of faith, right? But Krishna in our lives is a little more subtle, a little more sublime. So that unflinching faith in something that cannot be so easily seen and is not so apparent, that's faith. And why do we have that faith? We have it because it's imparted to us by the spiritual master. There's a nice verse from the Svetashvatara Upanishad, 6:23, famous verse, says, only unto those great souls who have implicit faith in both the Lord and the spiritual master are all the imports of Vedic knowledge automatically revealed. So faith comes first, then knowledge is revealed. It's not if I gain enough knowledge, then, okay, now I get it, now I have faith. Sometimes we think that I just need to know more and more facts. That's not necessarily going to do it. Knowledge is good. We need knowledge. We need renunciation. But we know that they actually come about from bhakti. From bhakti, knowledge and renunciation will arise. So faith comes first, then knowledge is revealed. So as that faith becomes stronger, as knowledge is revealed, the devotee feels more and more under the personal protection and guidance of Krishna. In a purport to, I guess it's Bhagavad Gita 241, where Prabhupada quotes that verse in Svetashvatara Upanishad, Prabhupada says, situated in everyone's heart, Krishna deals differently according to the living entity's position. The living entity's position is to be under the protection of the illusory energy or under Krishna's personal protection. So we have two choices. We take shelter of Krishna, we can take shelter of Maya. We can be protected by Maya, we can be protected by Krishna. And it's actually a pretty easy choice, isn't it? We don't have to think too deeply about that one. When a living entity is fully surrendered, he's under the direct protection of Krishna, and Krishna gives him all intelligence by which he could advance in spiritual realization. So we can see ignorance, doubts, fearlessness, they all go together. Not ignorance and doubt. And in other words, ignorance and doubts lead to fearfulness, and the elimination, eradication, leads to fearlessness. So even in the neophyte position, we do begin taking shelter of Krishna. We're not completely in this position with a fully surrendered soul, completely protecting, you know, who, that's one of the six symptoms of surrender, right? To always feel Krishna's protection. We may not be completely at that stage, but we do begin to experience and realize Krishna's protection. Krishna's helping us. Krishna's working with us. And he gives that protection even without asking. And we always have to remember that greatest protection is spiritual protection. I mean, we hear about devotees, especially as older devotees, getting sick, having, you know, all sorts of things, devotees leaving their body. Set me, how we say, well, how did Krishna not protect them? Well, in the material world, everyone leaves their body. That's a given. That's not Krishna not protecting. That's the laws of material nature. But what Krishna is protecting is he's protecting the spiritual life and spiritual advancement of his bhaktas. That is what is happening. And Krishna helps us to advance in Krishna consciousness. As we develop that mood of surrender, we realize that Krishna is our only shelter, that he is working in our best interest, even if we don't see it, helping us to advance in Krishna consciousness. I was thinking the residents of Vrindavan often were put in situations of tribulation, or put in situations of distress. The Pandavas were put in distress. Queen Kunti was put in distress. Devotees, it seems like, throughout the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam are put in distress. That's, you know, that's often what happens in Krishna's pastimes with his devotees. So we all may feel some distress, and what is the response of the great devotees that we are, who are our exemplars in the Srimad Bhagavatam, is they're taking shelter of Krishna. You know, Queen Kunti being, of course, probably the prime example. And not only taking shelter of Krishna, but saying, please give me more distress so I can take shelter of you more. I can't even claim to even understand that, what to speak of being on that platform of advancement. But it's pretty wonderful. It's pretty amazing. In other words, seeing distress and possible fearful situations as an opportunity to surrender, and as Queen Kunti says, an opportunity to see your lotus feet again and again. So that's the position of the devotees. So how do we develop that? How do we develop faith? How do we develop the mood of surrender? And how do we develop this courage as exemplified by Maharaj Parikshit, so that at the time of death, we are not fearful of the loss of the body, but we almost embrace it, knowing that we are simply going to Krishna? Well, you know, our answers, I wish I could come up with something original. Like, well, how do we do it? Because it's always kind of the same, isn't it? We have a formula that Prabhupada gave us, and it works. It's a formula of sadhana, of devotional practice, of hearing and chanting, and sadhusanga, association with devotees, and particularly taking shelter of the spiritual master and the great acharyas. So devotional service begins with hearing and chanting, Shravanam Kirtanam. In fact, I'm going back to the verse from the second canto of the Bhagavatam, O King, constant chanting of the holy name of the Lord after the ways to the great authorities is the doubtless and fearless way of success for all. That's actually such a great verse. I hadn't thought about it for a while, and it was reminded of me again. Hearing and chanting under the instruction of the great authorities, you know, the acharyas and the guru, this is the way to become doubtless and fearless and attain success. So we achieve that through sadhana in association with devotees under the instruction of Srila Prabhupada and the spiritual master. And when we do that, devotees have no need to fear. Very nice verse from the Bhagavatam 6:17-28. Narayana Paraksarve Nakutaschana Bibhyate Svarga Pavarga Narakesh Vapitulyarta Darshina. devotees solely engaged in the devotional service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Narayan never fear any condition of life. For them, the heavenly planets, liberation, and the hellish planets are all the same, for such devotees are interested only in the service of the Lord. So that's the position of advanced devotees, such as Maharaj Parikkhit. And of course, for us, who are not on that platform yet, we can achieve that realization through the practice of bhakti yoga, through the process of sadhana, hearing and chanting, through following Srila Prabhupada and the association devotees. Our faith increases, our doubts become eradicated, our knowledge increases, our ignorance is dispelled, ignorance meaning identifying with the body, and therefore the fear of death and the fear of everything else that happens in life becomes lessened more and more as we take shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna. Okay. Hare Krishna, that's what I have. I'll go to Srila Prabhupada. Questions, comments? Go ahead.
Thank you for the class. I just wanted to share, if you allow me, some things I heard in the classes by some senior devotees on this topic of faith that were very enlightening to me. Many years ago, I heard Praladananda Swami
heart.
So he said, you develop faith in that which you put your heart into. Mm. You know, because I was thinking, you know, why is it that, you know, we intellectually understand, we accept, but we are not always like convinced in heart. So he was explaining that, where are you placing your heart? In other words, you know, we can understand things intellectually, but then we're maintaining our anarchas. That means we're still putting our heart into the material world. Mm-hmm.
Placing our heart into. And then another thing that was really inspiring to me, I really wanted to share this. A few days ago, I heard the class by Vaisheshika Prabhu. He inspires me so much by his dedicated sadhana and hearing and chanting, his dedication to Prabhupada's books and, of course, book distribution, but so much hearing and chanting. And one devotee asked this similar question at the end of the class. She said, why is it that sometimes insecurities arise, even though we know all these things theoretically, we have the knowledge, why do the insecurities arise? And he said, it's because of the lack of hearing and chanting. Mm-hmm. So again, like, you know, hearing and chanting, but then it seems like it has to be done with a certain quality. Like Krishna is saying, have you heard this with attentive mind, Arjuna? And have, you know, if we hear with attentive mind, then the doubts are removed, and then we have the faith, which is in the heart. And then he said one more thing that really inspires me in my sadhana. He said that when we have to engage in inspirational sadhana, like not just to get it done, like, you know, we've done our duty, we've chanted 16 rounds, but he said when you sit to chant your 16 rounds, to chant your rounds, you have to beg from Krishna to get the taste, to get the realization, to get inspiration. And he says that, you know, we have a right for that. That, you know, that when you complete your chanting, you're inspired. And he said, so you should beg for that. Because without that inspiration from sadhana, without that higher taste, I think we're bound to, you know, to follow our, you know, material desires, our anarchas. They're very difficult to remove. And then when anarchas are there, then the doubts are there. So anyway, I just made that connection. I thought, like, you know, sufficient hearing and chanting, hearing from Shastra, and then attentive chanting and begging Krishna for that higher taste. So anyway.
Thank you. You said it so well. I can't even really comment on it. I couldn't possibly improve on that. So very nicely. I think you should consider giving classes. Yeah. Nice realizations. Next.
So you had mentioned about how the biggest fear for the human being is death, and I immediately kind of thought about the fear of emotional pain, which also comes from the fear of death. I mean, from psychology's point of view, they say that your fear of pain, emotional pain, is fear of being rejected, fear of being shunned by your tribe, you know, and then being alone equals possibly dying. So
possibly.
Okay. So in that, in regards to emotional pain, so where does emotion sit in our body? Because, I mean, we do have to have some feeling to relate to Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
So is our emotions are part of our physical body, or, you know, the mind, or where do we sit?
I've thought about that. It's a great question, actually. My understanding is emotions are considered part of the mind. If we're just looking at the eight, you know, elements that comprise, so it's obviously part of the subtle body. We have mind, intelligence, false ego, and emotions are usually linked with the mind. Sometimes I've seen there's another element of heart, Prita. Is anyone familiar with that? That sometimes is also mentioned. Now, the other thing, also remember that there's both spiritual and material. I mean, in other words, the mind can become spiritualized, intelligence can become spiritualized, and those feelings also can become spiritualized. So in other words, and that's the purification process. The purification process is just like a conversion process, right? We're converting the material to spiritual. You know, it probably gives the different examples of the, you know, the rod put into the fire becomes like fire, and, you know, there's several examples like that. So, yeah, it's not that in bhakti yoga, you know, we have these emotions and we give up emotion, or we give up feeling, or we give up, though they become spiritualized so that those feelings and emotions become directed more and more towards Krishna, Krishna's devotees, they become spiritualized. And that's another reason why the association of devotees is so important. Because in our neophyte stage, we don't so much experience, at least all the time, that I'm directly feeling and experiencing Krishna, right? So, but we can experience and have relationship and love with devotees, Krishna's devotees. So, you know, in other words, that's why there must be guru, there must be sadhu sangha, right? These things must be there, because if we think, especially as new devotees, you know, it's just me and Krishna, it's probably not going to work, you know? We won't be successful that way. So again, the feelings, emotions that we have by hearing and chanting, they become more spiritualized by association of devotees. We direct those in proper ways. And yeah. But yeah, it is interesting, because in psychology, and being a psychologist, it's like we often distinguish between thoughts and feelings. So you think, well, if they're both, you know, but they're different. My understanding from, you know, our Vedic perspective is they're different aspects of the mind. The mind has, because, you know, sometimes we even think about thinking, feeling, willing, right? The three aspects of mental, of the mind that Prabhupada has mentioned. So thinking, feeling, willing, you know, those are distinct. They're distinct, but they all are part of the, you know, sort of encompassed by the mind. That's my understanding. I'll try to think about it, and maybe Maharaj can help us to explain this better. Go ahead, please.
I wasn't raising my hand.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
But I was raising my hand, but not for that.
All right.
Particular.
Well, go ahead, whatever you want, like.
Although I was reading yesterday something in philosophy about that sounded so much like our thinking, feeling, and willing. The idea that once willing takes place, the action is inevitable. And we do see examples of that. One devotee was having some problem, spiritual problem. We were trying to preach to him, you know this one. And he said, there's no use preaching to me. It's got to the willing platform. Now, it's too late now, because it's gone mm-hmm. through. I know the philosophy. He said, I know the yeah. philosophy. It's gotten to the willing platform. It's too late, no matter what you're telling me now, it's gonna happen. And it was interesting that I saw that corroborated in Western philosophy. What my comment, which I always try to turn into a question, asking for feedback, I suppose, is that if not being afraid of death or fearlessness were the ultimate goal, then the path of bhakti would become relativized. It would share with other processes being able to achieve that. Yeah. For instance, in Bhagavad Gita, it says, yadichtaya chupapanam svargadvaram apavritam sukhina kshatriya parta labhante yudham idrisham. It says, happy are those kshatriyas to whom such fighting spirits come, even unsought, opening for them the doors of the heavenly planets. So in other words, even without full knowledge, just being really paka kshatriya, then one will not have fear of death. He'll be ecstatic, you know, at the prospect. But it doesn't mean that he has full knowledge, because he may be thinking, I'm going to go to a heavenly planet. Another example are impersonalists. You hear stories of Zen Buddhists who take death very, very lightly. Sometimes they just make a joke about it when they're dying. There's one story that he was standing on his head, and he said, has anyone ever died standing on their head? He said, no, we don't know. Okay, I'm going to do it like that. And he's standing on his head, and he died standing on his head. His wife came along. She was also an advanced Zen Buddhist. And she saw him, and she just said, what is he doing? He just pushed the body over. And he said, he always had a sense of humor when he's living, even has a sense of humor when he's dead. So, I mean, there are stories, and some of them are probably true, that certainly we know kshatriyas have that. So, fortunately, the good news is that in bhakti yoga, the goal is even more sublime than not being afraid of death. And also, for our purposes, for all intents and purposes for us, it's the only way that we'd be free from that fear. But yeah, it's very exciting as we get from our 60s and go into our 70s. You know, it's a pretty exciting situation, isn't it? I mean, how free from fear are we actually, what level of have we achieved that? So.
Well, I don't know if it's exciting, but it certainly gives us that opportunity. It's there. And what you're saying, of course, I think is fairly much corroborated in this discussion about Brahman realization and what Shukadeva Goswami was saying, that, you know, in other words, Shukadeva Goswami was saying the same thing. Through Brahman realization, you can overcome this and be free from death. And Parikkhita is saying, no, I don't really, that's not the way I see it. I'm not going in that direction. But he wants to take shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna, seeing that that's actually much higher. And actually, I didn't mention earlier, but in the purport to verse 5 of chapter 6, Bhishma Chakravarti Thakur mentions that Parikkhita's almost a little irritated of Shukadeva, you know, offering Brahman realization as a possibility. He's saying, like, what do you mean? You've been telling me about Krishna now for, you know, 7 days, telling, you know, to take advantage of, to take shelter of Krishna. I've got no use for this Brahman realization, you know, but I simply want to take shelter of Krishna's lotus feet. And of course, we know from the discussion in the last chapter that Maharaj Parikkhita actually ultimately isn't even killed by the snake bird, right? He leaves his body actually before that, you know, and he never really has to experience physical death by the snake bird, by the mercy of Krishna. But that's another story. Okay, thank you, Maharaj. Anything else? I don't know. Okay. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.